Carol Engelhart grew up on a farm outside of Elkader in the 1950s. Iowa was enjoying post-war prosperity in a period before the nation lost its innocence. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In his new book, The Farm at Holstein Dip, An Iowa Boyhood, Engelhart recreates the farm of his youth in meticulous detail. He's created a time capsule that transports readers back to rural Iowa in the 1950s. I'll talk with him. Then later in the hour, we'll talk about preserving history in a more tangible way. I'll talk with Jeff Morgan about the new exhibit at the State Historical Museum of Iowa. It's called Saving Our Stuff. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we're going to talk about preserving our history in a very tangible way. The State Historical Museum has a new exhibit called Saving Our Stuff. But first, we're going to focus on the preservation of memories. Carol Engelhart is a professor of history emeritus at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. He's written about his childhood on a farm outside of Elkader. It's called The Farm at Holstein Dip, An Iowa Boyhood. If you grew up in Iowa in the 1940s and 50s, we would love to hear from you today. What things do you think it's hard for Iowans today to understand about life then? What do you miss? What do you not miss? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Carol Engelhart is here with me now. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, I'm happy to do this.
What prompted you to sit down and start writing about your childhood?
Well, I had thought about doing this for a long time. And professionally, history had changed and had shifted toward greater interest in local matters and lives of ordinary people. So that was one factor. And then the other was personal. I have two daughters, and they heard the stories and encouraged me to write these memories down. And then I finally retired, and I had the opportunity to do so.
I think a lot of us take our personal experiences for granted. And, of course, growing up on a farm in rural Iowa, that's not something that a lot of people think about as an exceptional experience. At what point did you start thinking about your youth as an important part of history?
Well, in the 1970s, you had Alex Haley's book, Recovering His African Heritage, The Roots Phenomena. I suppose that contributed to it. I know I started to look into my ancestors at that point and try to chart family history then. So I think that was a big part of that. And then also the changes in small-town life and small farming in Iowa. As that disappeared into the past, I thought it was worthwhile telling the story of that generations of Iowans. What was it like to live in the 40s and 50s?
When you decided to write this book, and in the book, you really recreate this world of your childhood in meticulous detail. How did you prompt those memories to come back to you? How did you do that research so that you could have the specific details about your house and your farm and your school?
Yeah. Well, I started out writing down home and just trying to remember and write down my my memories. And I discovered that over time, I started writing this book in 2008, and it was submitted for publication in 2011, so this was a three-year process. I discover over time that memories keep bubbling to the surface as you think about this and as you go through this exercise. I supplemented it with a lot of material. I relied heavily on the Clayton County Register, which was published in Elkader, the hometown newspaper. I also relied on other memoirs. I relied on histories of Iowa County, histories of agriculture, histories of small-town life. So I put my memories and the memories of my family and the stories of my family into a larger social context and tried to connect it to other economic and social trends of the 40s and 50s.
In describing the house that you lived in and the farm, did you also go back to pictures to try to put things together that maybe you didn't remember completely clearly?
Yeah, photographs are important, and I'm the keeper of the family photographs. I'm the last surviving member of my family. I can't... Well, photographs were important, and I recall looking at photograph albums, and I guess I did use those to recall some memories.
Tell me a little bit about the house that you grew up in.
Well, it was, I suppose, an ordinary white farmhouse, typical of many other farmhouses. I was told that it was built in the 1880s. And then an addition was added on perhaps 20 years later. It had a dirt basement, kind of a dirty, dingy place that contained a furnace that didn't work. We put in a new furnace in 1948. And it also contained the cream separator. That's where we separated the cream from our dairy herd. And we sold cream in the early days to the cooperative creamery in Alcater. It had, I'm trying to think of the rooms now. I think it had nine rooms in it. And most of our life was spent in the kitchen and living room. I know one of the rooms was a storeroom where my father kept seed corn and my mother kept jars for canning and all sorts of things like that. It had an attic. A lot of interesting things were stored in the attic, and I remember as a kid spending time there and looking at that stuff and wondering what it was for or why it wasn't used anymore. It did not have electricity. It did not have indoor plumbing. We got electricity in 1954 when my parents bought the farm from my grandfather. They had rented it for 17 years at that point, and they put electricity in then as soon as they owned the farm. They never got indoor plumbing.
Never?
Never, as long as they lived on the farm.
Wow.
My father was afraid of the cost. I think my mother would have been happy to invest in it.
Sure.
It was easier on him to live without it than it was on her. The lack of running water and indoor plumbing added a lot to her chores.
Well, and I'm sure that you and your brother probably thought quite a bit about that as well.
Yes, the outdoor toilet in Iowa winter is a daunting prospect.
Sure.
Yep.
And you write about your brother trying to time his bathroom visit so that he could go at school.
Yeah, yeah. He told me about that when I was writing the book. I had never considered that possibility. But he was always older and wiser than I was.
Well, we'll continue talking about this in just a moment. My guest is Carol Englehart. He is the author of The Farm at Holstein Dip, An Iowa Boyhood, remembering his childhood growing up on a farm outside of Alcater, Iowa in the 1940s and 50s. And we want to hear your memories this hour as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jean is on the line from Belle Plaine. Hello, Jean.
Hi.
And you grew up during this time?
Yes, yes. I was born in 37. And so I was going to school, and when the war ended, I was 8 years old, and we were all very worried about the atomic bomb. So, of course, we had instructions about getting under our desks and, you know, that kind of thing. But when I was in high school, we went to high school, it was 7th through 12th, and the televisions, we only saw one television antenna in our area, and we didn't know anything about it because my mother worked two jobs, so we lived with our grandmother. And so the teacher would sometimes sit on the corner of his desk and visit with the kids about what they watched on TV the night before. And those of us without without access to TV, we were pretty poor. We just didn't know what they were talking about. And it's so sometimes I wonder now about the technology, if the poorer students are running into that same thing, where they're hearing the conversations between teachers and students about things that are beyond their reach.
I'm sure that still happens, Jean. Thank you so much for sharing your memories.
You're very welcome.
And Carol, you write about the advent of television in your life. And of course, before that came radio, and you were a big radio fan.
Yes, I was. We had a battery-powered radio, and the batteries would run down. And so in the summertime, we did without radio. My father didn't think we should be inside listening to radio during the summer months, so he never recharged the batteries until fall for the listening season, if you will.
When did you get a TV?
1957. I was I was starting my junior year of high school when we got a television set, and I became a television fan. But I don't think it had nearly the impact on me that radio did.
Your dad was obviously a late adopter in a lot of things. For example, the indoor plumbing we were talking about a moment ago. But it kind of surprised me that he adopted TV not super early, but he didn't wait too long.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that became apparent to me from writing this book is that both of my parents, although they grew up on farms, farmed by horses and homes without electricity, they were quite willing to adopt modern technologies as soon as they were able or as soon as they thought they could afford them, and quite willing to adopt things that made their lives easier and more comfortable.
And you write about your mom spending many hours with the radio during the day, which
yes.
I think a lot of women on the farm did.
Yes, they did. Mother did not drive, and so and she was alone in the house most of the day, because we were off at school and my father was outside working. So radio was a good companion to her, and if I was sick or stayed home from school, then I entered that world of soap operas. I still remember listening to those, and also before I started helping with the milking and so on, I would be in the house while she was fixing meals and listening to the newscast. And I can still remember the urgency of some of those Cold War newscasts that came over the radio.
I'm talking with Carol Engelhart. He has written a book called The Farm at Holstein Dip, an Iowa Boyhood, remembering his childhood growing up on a farm outside of Elkader in the 1940s and 50s. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Carol Engelhart. He's a professor of history emeritus at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, and he grew up on a farm outside of Elkader in the 1940s and 50s. He's written about his childhood on that farm in a new book called The Farm at Holstein Dip, an Iowa Boyhood. And Carol, one of the things that you write about in great detail that I really enjoyed was all of the work that your mother did. Was it difficult for you to try to recreate all of those tasks that she had to deal with on a daily basis?
Well, again, I had memories of her working. I remember my first chores. Chores for farm kids started at about age six, and small kids help mother and big kids helped father, and so chicken chores. I helped her with the chicken store chores. I also had the job of bringing in wood from the woodpile for the cook stove, and also the corn cobs to start the fire in the wood cook stove in the kitchen. So I had I helped dry dishes after the meals. My brother and father would be doing the milking, and I would be in the kitchen helping her with chores. So I had some memories and some experiences in those chores firsthand. And I supplemented that with other memoirs who talked about women's work, agricultural history that talked about women's work. So again, I was tying together my memories with more detailed accounts that helped fill out the story.
As you were growing up, what kind of work were you expected to do on the farm? After you got done carrying that wood for the cook stove and got old enough to go out to the barns?
Well, bringing the cows home during the summertime became my chore. My brother eventually, when he turned 16, started working at another job, and so I took over his responsibilities. And during the winter, putting down hay from the hay mow and feeding the cattle, I started milking by hand at age 11. And that continued until I was 16 when we got our first milking machine. Every Saturday during school was devoted to cleaning barns and so on, and then going to the straw pile and getting fresh bedding for the animals. So that was a typical Saturday chore.
Even though you did a lot of work on the farm, you also write about having a lot of freedom and a lot of time to play.
Yes, yes. It's quite different from today. There weren't that many structured activities, and we had great freedom to roam the farm. Town kids too, you know, with bicycles, you could go places and do things, and there weren't the concerns about child safety that there are today.
The name of the book, The Farm at Holstein Dip, comes from one of the places that you used to like to visit when you did have that freedom.
Yes. We virtually had a swimming pool in our backyard, so Holstein Dip is the old swimming hole, which was located perhaps a quarter mile from our house underneath the bridge on the county road. And it was the municipal pool for Elkader. We were located about a mile from Elkader, and during the summer, perhaps as many as 30 to 40 children would bike or walk out to go swimming in Holstein Dip.
So it was a very busy place.
Yes, it was. It was great fun. Those are my fondest memories, I think, of childhood. And I remember dragging on my way to bring the cows home after a day in the pool. I was pretty wiped out from the swimming.
Well, and you weren't just swimming. You write about how you would dive down to move rocks from the bottom.
Yes, yes. The swimming hole was about 5 feet deep at its deepest part, and when you had those Iowa thunderstorms, the creek would rise and become quite turbulent and wash in rock and debris and so on. So we learned fairly early that we needed to check the bottom before diving in after rainstorms to move rock and that had might have washed in and made it dangerous to dive.
Well, and you learned that because somebody hit their head on a rock, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Were there other injuries? I mean, by today's standards, that does not sound safe.
No, I think that's the most serious one, and that was not a terribly serious one. He cut his head and, you know, bled quite a bit from a head wound. And I remember him, we hustling down to our house, and Mother patched him up. My brother ripped a couple of fingernails out. He was trying to roll a rock, and it rolled back and took the fingernails with it. Those are the only two injuries that I recall there. Sometimes people broke a bottle or something, and there was broken glass, so there may have been a cut foot or something like that. But
you also write about finding the remnants of different kinds of social gatherings there at Holstein Dip, too, more adult gatherings.
Yeah, yeah. Holstein Dip was a place that adults came to party and late at night, and sometimes disturbed us with the noise that that went on, and also sex was involved in those meetings, we discovered the next day.
That must have been a source of a lot of discussion among the youngsters.
Well, yes, that was. We knew that there was an adult life out there that we did not fully comprehend and were curious about.
I'm talking with Carol Engelhardt. He's the author of The Farm at Holstein Dip in Iowa, Boyhood Remembering His Childhood Growing Up on a Farm right outside of Elkader, Iowa in the 1940s and 50s. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. We'd love to hear your memories. And Judy is on the line now from Martinsdale. Hello, Judy.
Good morning. What a wonderful conversation. And it brings up lots of memories of when I spent many summers at my grandparents' farm near Karnes, Iowa, which is up in northwest Iowa. And my sisters and I just had full run of the farm. And it was an old ramshackle farm. It was very similar to what your guest is describing. No indoor plumbing, outhouses. But we just thought it was our piece of heaven. We would go out into the groves and build playhouses out in the groves. We would take twine out of my grandfather's tool shed, and then we would, you know, just kind of string it around a bunch of trees and make all kinds of different rooms. And then we'd go to the junk pile, and we would reclaim old empty bottles of oil of Olay and Noxzema and my grandma's spice cans, and we would put those on old orange crates that we had nailed to the trees. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful way to live as a child.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your memories, Judy.
You're welcome.
Carol, you seem to remember that time very fondly, the kind of freedom that you had growing up. As a father, did you try to recreate that kind of freedom for your kids?
Not so much. We lived, they were born here in Fargo, Moorhead, and so they lived in an urban environment, and they had the run of the block, which wasn't bad when they were children. I think we had 17 kids here in a small area that were all about the same age, so they played together. But they didn't have the freedom to roam around the town or roam around the farm or turn the farm into a playground like we did and like the most recent caller described.
You write a lot about food in your book as well, and there was so much food in
yes,
the book.
Yes. Well, people were physically active. I think that's one difference between farming then and farming now. And the mechanization has advanced that the kind of hard physical labor that my father and mother did, probably there's less of that, I'm assuming, on farms today. So people ate a lot, ate big meals, and farm wives spent a lot of time in food preparation. And you had harvest meals, too, for haying and for thrashing. We thrashed until 1954, and so you'd have, a house full of hungry farm workers there that needed to be fed at mealtime. And they got a thresher's meal, which by definition was a very large meal with a lot of meat.
Well, and you write about your dad. He was clearly not a man who indulged in many luxuries, but he did have a sweet tooth.
Yes, he did. Yes, he liked to have sweets with all three meals. And mother was a great baker. She was of Norwegian descent, and that showed up at Christmas time with the delicacies that she baked for Christmas. And that was always a favorite time of year. I loved eating those sweets that she prepared for the holidays.
Jean Marie is on the line now from Elkader, and I believe you guys know each other. Is that Jean Marie?
Yes.
Hi, tell me about your connection.
Well, I don't actually know Carol in person. I did kind of get a preview of his book prior to its publication from a mutual friend, Larry Stone, here in Elkader, who's kind of a well-known naturalist and writer.
Mm-hmm.
But our real connection is that the farm is now in a trust that my husband left to me and my children. I am a co-administrator to it. And I thought maybe Carol would be interested in knowing what we've done with it since we've owned it. We've had it about 26 years.
Oh, wow. What have you done with it?
Well, we took the crops all out of production and planted it all to trees. It's kind of like our big private park. It's beautiful. We try to limit the people that go on it because we don't want it to become open property, you know. But there are trails that wander up the hills and through the trees, and there's a beautiful little creek that runs through it, the same one, of course, that Carol is talking about. My grandchildren love it. They can't wait. In fact, often when they come to visit me, I don't have any grandchildren or grandchildren real close by here, but when they come to visit, they often go right to the farm, and they don't even come to the house to see me. Or they'll send me a message and say, meet us at the farm. So that is the focal point for our family. We never lived there. I still live in a house in Elkader, but we all totally love that farm.
So you've tried to restore the land to what it was like before settlement.
Yeah, that's basically what it is, yes.
And do the buildings still stand on the farm?
Actually, the home and the buildings where Carol grew up, we sold that off a year or two after we bought it. We had had renters in there, and, you know, not being real true business people, it was a nuisance to have renters. And so I worried about the septic tank. I worried about the well going dry and all those things, you know. And that was during the drought years of the 1980s. So these people were getting out of farming. They approached us to see if we would sell the spot, and we did. And it was a good opportunity for all around, but we no longer own the house that Carol grew up in.
Well, Jean Marie, thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
You're welcome.
And Carol, so Jean Marie's grandkids are roaming some of the same woodlands you roamed as a kid.
That was wonderful to hear that. I really appreciated that. I mention in the book that I can no longer roam the hills and woods that I roamed as a child because the land is posted, and so I've respected their wishes and have not have not visited my childhood haunts. But it's wonderful to hear that her grandchildren are doing many of the same things that I did as a child. And I also mention in the book that one of my earliest memories was my father dynamiting stumps out of some of our small fields so he could, you know, put them into production. I don't think he'd be very happy to
see trees in his
see
fields.
Trees growing in his fields. But
well, we all have different ideas of what progress is.
Yeah. Well, I think this, given the quality of the land of that farm, I think this is just a wonderful use that they've put it to. But I think my father would have a tough time appreciating that.
Sure. Well, I'm so glad you called, Jean Marie. And Carol, we have just a couple of minutes before I have to let you go. What do you want people to take away from reading about what it was like to live on a farm in the 1940s and 50s?
Well, what I tried to do here was to recreate a way of life at a particular time. I think it was a good way of life. I think people lived that and had enjoyable lives. I think it was a life lived to human scale, and I think that might be a lesson that people could draw from it. You know, in this time of material abundance and huge homes and possessions of material goods, that if you look at this simpler time, maybe we don't have to have all the material goods that we think we have to have.
What did you learn by looking back in this way?
Well, I had a deep sense of gratitude to my parents for how they raised me. The values that they imparted, I think, have served me well as an adult, as a teacher of history in a college setting, very different from the setting in which I was raised. My wife came from a similar background, and we tried to impart these values into our children, too, that you know, work is important, responsibility is important, thrift and good management are important life skills to have.
when you write about your parents, they seem to fit kind of a stereotype that we have of many of the farmers of that generation. They were reticent. They didn't share with you their emotions. They weren't affectionate. Did you find in looking back at their lives and what they did for you and your brother that you felt more of that love by remembering?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't, as a child, I don't think I appreciated it. I write that my mother expressed her love through the food preparation and hospitality that she extended to guests. And, you know, that's something that occurred to me in writing this book. It's very, very evident.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciated speaking with you.
Carol Engelhardt is the author of The Farm at Holstein Dip, An Iowa Boyhood. In a moment, we'll talk about preserving our artifacts in this state. We've been talking about preserving memories so far. And we did have this comment shared on Facebook from Tom. He says, in the days of the polio epidemic, we lost a 5-year-old cousin. I was nicked by the tail end of it. Now dealing with post-polio syndrome, every day is different. On my worst days, I look at Merle's picture and thank God for living so long. We'll meet you someday, Merle. Thank you for sharing your memories, Tom, and for everybody who shared their memories this hour. In a moment, we'll talk about saving our stuff. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and now we're going to talk about preserving history in a physical way. There's a new exhibit open at the State Historical Museum of Iowa called Saving Our Stuff. Jeff Morgan is here with me. He's the Public Information Officer with the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs Office. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Great. Thanks for being on the show today.
Wonderful. I also have Pete Sixby here with us as well today.
Oh, terrific. And Jeff, where did this idea come from? I mean, a lot of museums obviously put on display stuff that has been preserved and stabilized. But what gave you the idea of having an exhibit about the work that you do at the museum?
Well, at the State Historical Museum, we have right around 100,000 different artifacts in our permanent collection. And at various times, any number of those could be undergoing conservation treatments, whether it's restoration or stabilization, or whether an item is looked at and determined that it might as well be best left untouched and to be kept as it is and preserved the way in its current state. But we do get a lot of questions from folks about things that in our permanent collection, and one of those things is how can we never see a lot of the things that were on display at the old historical building? When the State Historical Museum and the State Historical Society of Iowa moved to the new historical building in 1987, a lot of those materials have been on display for decades and decades and decades, and they have been in our permanent collection storage area undergoing conservation treatments or waiting to undergo conservation treatments.
And Pete, mm-hmm. your role is as a conservator at the museum, right?
That's correct.
And how long have you been with the State Historical Museum?
I was hired 17 years ago to start a conservation program for the Historical Society. At that time, there was a paper conservator in Iowa City, Jane Meggers, who retired a couple of years ago. So right now, I'm the only person doing conservation, and my specialty is in objects conservation.
This is work that usually probably a lot of people visiting the museum take for granted. What's a day in the life of a museum conservator like?
Well, it varies quite a bit. Well, the last 3 months has been working on this exhibit. What we wanted to do is kind of generate an awareness of what we do at the Historical Society. A lot of people don't realize all the different. And it's just not me doing conservation. We have a lot of other preservation experts doing paper conservation, archive conservation, and people don't realize that, what's going on behind the scenes. So we wanted to kind of generate that awareness and also encourage people to kind of look at their artifacts at home, things that are important to them, and, you know, kind of think about taking better care of them so that they can be enjoyed, you know, in the future by, you know, their families. And so I think that's kind of what we're trying to do, basically, with this exhibit.
And you're actually kind of on display as well, right?
Yes. We have a little mock conservation lab. It's kind of a quasi-lab. We can't do everything in it, but I plan to be in there working on some of the artifacts, and people can actually come up, and I will invite them in, and they can ask questions and kind of see what I'm doing. One of the items is a nice picture frame for one of the paintings that's being conserved in Chicago right now called Arcadia, and I'm actually going to gold leaf that frame, and people interested in seeing how gilding is done and how leaf is applied can come watch that. So I think it'll be real interesting.
When an item comes into the possession of the museum and you need to decide what is going to be done with it, how do you make that evaluation?
Oh, there's a lot of things that have to be determined. You know, what kind of importance it has curatorially, how it kind of fits into what our exhibit schedule is. A lot of what we do is exhibit driven. So that those kind of determinations have to be made, what our resources are, how much it's going to cost, and those kind of things. So there's a lot of things that have to be kind of weighed to determine whether that should be worked on now or be set at a different priority for a later date.
Well, there are different kinds of preservation. Obviously, a lot of us don't spend a lot of time thinking about this, but when you get something, do you need to decide, are we going to invest time to restore this to what it was like before? Are we going to do something to keep it in the same state that it is now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's basically two approaches to preservation, and one of those is conservation, which you basically try to keep the artifact in an as-is condition. The other is restoration, and that is returning it more to a original condition, as it would have looked like when it came off the factory floor or something like that. A lot of times these two approaches kind of come together, and you do a little bit of both. For example, if you had a table that was in need of restoration, you might want to put the leg on if it's missing a leg just to stabilize it, and that would be more of a restoration technique. So you just have to kind of look at each one individually to make that determination.
Some of the damage done to items is also part of the story of history. When you think about restoring something, do you also try to make sure that you can maintain that story? Like if there's a nick on a helmet, I can imagine that would be part of a story.
That's correct. And we have a section in the exhibit called the Untouchables, and these are artifacts that have been, for example, a silver set on a battleship. It was severely damaged, and taking those dents out, taking the tarnish off, would kind of alter that story. You know, artifacts tell a story, and what we try to do is do restoration or conservation so that story is maintained. One of the artifacts we have is Big Daddy's pot that he made his famous barbecue sauce, and it has a lot of the sauce still in the pot. In fact, we could hardly get close to it because there's so much spice to it that our eyes would start watering. But we didn't want to take that off because that tells a story, and it shows how much it was used, and so we just pretty much keep it as is. And there are a lot of artifacts like that where you just don't touch it. You want to keep it as is because it would alter the story that those artifacts tell.
I'm sure that you get a lot of things that you can't attend to right away. How do you store things so they don't continue to decay?
Well, we try to keep the environment at like the humidity and temperature at certain levels. Like a 50% humidity is kind of the standard right now in museums, and keeping the temperature at just kind of a comfortable level for people is good for artifacts also. For people who are storing things at home, it's good to keep them out of the attics and basements if you want to, you know, preserve them for a long time and keep them on the main levels where you have air conditioning. But museums go to a lot of trouble keeping their environments at a safe level for artifacts. For example, metals, you know, they corrode when humidity gets above 70%. So if you're storing metals, you want to make sure that your humidities are kept at good levels for that. And so each kind of artifact has to be, you have to kind of determine what the environment would be for the different types of materials.
Well, and just saying that makes it sound like most of our homes are really terrible places to keep historical artifacts.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's a real challenge, and it's a challenge for museums that are designed for it. So, you know, people really have to do a little research and ask questions. And, for example, sunlight is very detrimental to sensitive artifacts like paper or textiles. Like you wouldn't want to hang your grandmother's quilt out in the sun because it's going to fade very quickly out in sunlight. So those are kind of things that you have to think about, you know, when caring for your own artifacts.
Well, you mentioned hanging textiles. What is the best way? I know there are lots and lots of wedding dresses in attics and lots of quilts in attics. When you're keeping textiles that are important to you, should they be hung? Should they be laid down flat? What's the best way?
Well, I get a lot of questions about wedding dresses. Probably that's asked more than any other question. And what I recommend is you can buy archival boxes. They're acid-free papers. So the acid, like cardboard's very acidic, so you wouldn't want to put them in a cardboard box. I recommend wrapping the garment in acid-free tissue first and just kind of pat it out. And then put it in an archival box that can be closed up. You don't want any light touching it. And that's really the best way. And just be careful about sending it to dry cleaners and some of the commercial operations that don't have that expertise. But acid-free paper and boxes are really good for that kind of thing.
And try to find a closet in the part of the house that isn't exposed to extreme temperatures.
Exactly, exactly.
Pete, what's your favorite thing in this exhibit?
Well, I really like wooden artifacts. That's kind of my specialty. We have a really interesting piano that was donated recently, and it's actually back in the SOS lab. It was in the Orpheum Theater in downtown Des Moines at one time. It was painted silver, we believe, and then it was painted over after that. The piano's from 1927, and it's just really interesting. I took off some of the paint and uncovered the original label in the back and kind of went through the paint layers to determine, you know, what was done to it through the years. And then the question is, you know, where do you restore it back to? Do you put the silver paint back on like it was in the Orpheum Theater or back to the factory finish? And so those are kind of things that we're trying to determine right now. But very interesting piano. It doesn't have the full set of keys on it. I think it's a couple octaves short from a regular piano. So it's really interesting. So it's something I think people would enjoy seeing in the exhibit.
And do you do a lot of research to find out how that piano was used? I would guess that research would help you decide what you want to restore it to. But are you the person who also does that, or is there someone else who does that part of the work?
Well, the curators, the curatorial staff does a lot of the research, but it's also something that I also do, especially with materials like and methods of construction and, you know, what materials were used and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's kind of a where we both kind of work together, the curatorial staff and conservation together, to kind of determine what's the best approach for that artifact.
Jeff Morgan, what's your favorite part of this exhibit?
Well, you know, there's a number of things in there. The Big Daddy's barbecue sauce stirring pot that Pete mentioned earlier is one of my favorite because I have sampled some of that sauce in the past. But there's also in there a piece of the World Trade Center that we received some time ago, and we have that on display. And that's one of the examples of an artifact that holds tremendous historical value, not only for the state of Iowa, but for the entire country as well. The paintings, I think, are very neat.
Yeah, we have we've been sending paintings to a conservator in Chicago for, I think, since 2004, and he's restored, conserved about 50 of our paintings. And the really neat thing is he does it just for the cost of materials. He retired from his business, and this is just a way of giving back to government agencies and nonprofit agencies. So it's just really been a good thing for us to have him working on these paintings. And there's about 10 to 15 of his paintings on display in the SOS exhibit.
And, Jeff, how long will this exhibit be at the museum?
Well, it's open-ended run right now, and we encourage people to come down and check it out and see Pete when he's up in the the exhibit conservation area and interact with him. And he'll be available to discuss some of the projects that he's working on and some of the treatments that he uses. It did open recently, and we've had pretty strong turnout for it. In addition to our Iowa in the Civil War, Nothing But Victory exhibition, which is on display as well, right there in the museum. We've had about 15,000 people come through that exhibit, and now they have an opportunity to come see Saving Our Stuff as well.
Pete, I imagine that you probably spend a lot of time working by yourself. How is it to be working in a museum with lots of visitors coming past and talking with you and looking at you?
Well, it'll be different. I'm welcoming the opportunity, actually. It's kind of nice just to interact with people and see what they're interested in, and also kind of help them with what they may have at home that I can, you know, give advice on how to take care of things. So, yeah, I'm welcoming it. It'll be a nice change.
Thinking back over the years that you've been doing this, what project do you think took you the longest to complete?
That's a good question. Let's see. When I first started a long time ago, I worked on a horse-drawn hearse. And there were a lot of components missing on that some little decorative elements that had to be turned on a lathe and then finished in silver to kind of make them look like silver artifacts. So that was something that took a while. A lot of the treatments you do for a while and you step away from it and maybe months before you get back to it. So it's kind of hard to say, you know, the total time. But they're all a challenge. You know, if you want to be a conservator, make sure you have lots of patience because it really takes a lot. It's very meticulous. And anymore, it's become more technical, so you need a lot of science background and chemistry and things like that.
Well, what do you do to prepare yourself to be a conservator?
I think you really have to love it. And if you're in school, you know, take art history classes, take studio art, take chemistry. I think most of the graduate schools, which are only three or four in the United States, require like a full 2 years of college chemistry. And then I also recommend working with somebody. Volunteer at museums and work with a conservator and just see what it's like and get some experience under your belt with it. And you'll have a kind of better idea what it's all about and a much better chance of getting into some of the graduate schools.
Is there a dream project for you that you would love to work on someday?
Well, the closest I've come to a dream project in the past, it wasn't in Iowa, it was actually in Arkansas, and it was on a carousel, these wooden horses that were hand-carved, and it was restoring those. And I only worked on it for a couple of years, but something similar to that would be really interesting.
All right. Well, Pete Sixby, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you.
And Jeff Morgan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Pete Sixby is a conservator at the State Historical Museum. Jeff Morgan is the Public Information Officer at the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs Office. We were talking about a new exhibit at the State Historical Museum of Iowa called Saving Our Stuff. You can go visit and see Pete at work. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Our production assistant today is Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Rick Fredrickson in Des Moines. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, happy, healthy kids in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
I'm Ben Kiefer. Next time on